This is my PhD Experience Podcast, the podcast devoted to graduate students, aspiring students, early career researchers interested in learning tips to help them get hired in graduate school and excel as a researcher. I am your host, Anthony.
Welcome to another episode of my PhD Experience Podcast. I am your host, Anthony, and with me today is a special guest, a friend of mine, Dr. Christina. It's my pleasure to have you on my podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kindly introduce yourself to our audience.
All right. Like you said, my name is Dr. Christina Alex Oji. I'm a Nigerian. I'm a demographer and a population scientist. I had my bachelor's degree in demography and social statistics at the Obafemi Awolowo University, Ile Ife. I graduated in 2008. I had my master's degree in sociology, demography, and population studies option at the University of Ibadan in 2012. And I graduated with a PhD in demography and population studies from the DPS program at the University of the Witwatersrand, Johannesburg, South Africa in 2021. I love to talk, obviously. I think you can't get very far in the research world without loving to talk. I love to meet people. I love to read. I love to write. I think that pretty much sums me up.
Oh, great, great. I was going to ask about your hobbies, but you already covered those. So maybe what I would like to ask, just is like an icebreaker now, is what movie or series are you currently watching?
The truth is I'm really not a TV person anymore. I've never really been a movies person. I'm not really a TV person. In fact, I don't have a TV in my house for that reason. Because I just can't. I think I just can't anymore. And I think that's one of the side effects of doing my PhD. I went for a period of about more than a year that I did not watch TV. So I think I just got used to that. So now, even watching a movie, but if you want to know the movie I watched the most recently, that was The Black Book, the movie by Edie T.F. Young. Yeah, so that is the most recent movie I've watched. It was about a month and a half ago.
Yeah, I actually watched that movie. It was so interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not, and I would not have watched that movie had I not been with, you know, family who were just like, okay, it's Sunday night. What should we do? Let's watch a movie on Netflix. Okay, what movie do you recommend? Because really, I don't. So yeah. I'm not a movie person. I am definitely not a series person because I feel if you can't tell your entire story in 2 hours, please count me out.
Series can be time consuming and then the
story gets boring at some point.
Yeah.
It's not even about the boring. I feel like it's too much, it's asking of too much commitment from me. So if you can't wrap up your story very nicely in 2 hours, sorry. I'm done.
For me, I watch movies, maybe just once in 2 months. Not a lot, but I watch football a lot.
I love to read, actually. I think that's how I de-stress. I think reading for me is much. I love light reading. I love fiction. I love African writers. You know, I think for me, reading is more my thing.
Yeah, which book are you currently reading?
Right now, I'm not reading anything. I think there's been a lot of work stress, so I haven't really had time to read anything right now. But I think I love African writers. I love Chimamanda Adichie. I love Wole Soyinka, Chinua Achebe. Many other writers I discovered along the road. Some I can't even remember their names. There was this book I read that I really loved recently. I Do Not Come to You by Chance. And funny enough, I can't remember the author, but I really enjoyed it. So I have a lot of ebooks, you know. I have a lot of ebooks. Sometimes I get them free of charge. Sometimes friends send them to me. So I have a really big library of ebooks that some I've read. There's this particular one I like to read because it's very funny. It's like a book of Irish fairy tales that are written in a very funny way. So sometimes when I really feel, you know, I just want to laugh, I pull up the book and just dip into a random story.
Wow.
Wow. So I think that's the way that's one of my hobbies. That's why I said I love to read. You know, I love to read. And of course, as a researcher, you read anything and everything. You sometimes you want to be current with world events, you know, every time, especially as a demographer. Every time, you know, something, every single day, something of demographic significance happens. So you want to be on top of world events to know, okay, how does this affect me? And how is this going to add to my research? So I think those are the things for me. But watching TV, I think maybe because I spend too much time in front of a computer screen. So
yeah, but I also understand that anything that competes for your time might also
yeah.
I also have to take the back side, especially if you have important deadlines. Yeah.
Exactly.
When would you say was the decision point to enroll in a PhD? Have you always sort of thought you were going to do PhD? When would you say was that decision point and why?
Okay. So I think the decision to do a PhD started in my last year of my undergraduate studies, my final year at IFE. You know, at final year, you have this, you know, different epiphanies where you are thinking about what am I going to do with the rest of my life. So, you know, for 4 years, you've been in a structured program and you begin to think of, okay, so this is coming to an end, you know, and what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And I think it was impressed on me strongly to go into academia. It was impressed on me very strongly. I think we never spoke. She's someone I had just admired from afar. One of the female lecturers in our department then also had a great deal to do with it. I know she probably never, she may never know, you know, that she was one of my sources of inspiration for an academic career. I just admired her, should I say, her poise, her self-confidence, and all of that. And I just always felt like I'd love to be like this person. So it wasn't really looking to me like, oh, I'd end up as a lecturer or as a researcher or whatever. But by the time I got into final year, it kept on, you know, being more impressed on me. So by that point, of course, we go for the mandatory National Youth Service program. I already knew that immediately after the NYSC for me, it was going to be a master's. At that point, actually, I was, you know, at the crossroads of many points. I did not know whether I wanted to travel abroad. The funds were not there. Not much information was available at that point for scholarships and funding. So I thought, okay, maybe the next best thing, after all, it's a master's I want to do. So let me look for a master's program in Nigeria. At least that one at that point was affordable for me. So that was how I ended up, you know, enrolling. In fact, I was still on the NYSC program when I got the form, the entry admission form to the master's program at the University of Ibadan. I think I was already just bored of the environment. And for some reason, I just felt that if I stayed in OAU for my master's program, I wasn't necessarily going to learn anything new. I mean, I was going to have the same lecturers. I was going to have the same... At that point, I'd even already gone over the master's syllabus. And I could see that there wasn't really any so much extra that I would be learning. Well, that was my point of view at that point, that there was not so much extra that I would be learning. So I decided maybe if I go to a new institution, you know, new people, new ways of doing things, there's a possibility that I'm going to learn much more. And that is what happened, because by the time I got to UI, University of Ibadan, I met with... Incidentally, in the sociology program, we also had a lot of young, you know, academics. As at then, we had young academics who were already doing, you know, really great things. And it was a different kind of environment, which of course meant it came with its own challenges and its own learning opportunities. So by the time I did my master's, I concluded my master's in the University of Ibadan. I met a professor who is now a professor emeritus, who took me on as a mentee. In fact, I didn't even ask him. He just saw me and he decided to take me under his wing. And one of the conversations, you know, we had in his office then, he asked me, he said, okay, now master's is over. What do you want to do? And I told him I wanted to start my PhD immediately. This was in 2012, I think late 2012. And he said, okay, you know. And he asked me several questions. And I remember one of the questions he asked me then. He said, with what he had seen about me, that he also wanted to recommend that I do a PhD. But he wanted to know my thoughts initially. So when I told him that I was already planning to do a PhD, he said, okay. Then he asked me a question. He said, do I want to do the PhD, or is somebody, my family, maybe my parents or siblings or somebody somewhere pushing me to do a PhD? And I said, no, that it was a personal decision. And he told me, he said, that's very good. He said, if you decide to do a PhD, because a PhD is a rocky road, he said, you will have days when you want to give up. But if it's a personal decision on your own, you will try your best to surmount those challenges. Because he told me, he said, a PhD is a very challenging thing. And it is good that I had already decided that I wanted to do it. And so he was the one who, even he told me, he said, with what he'd seen, that he would like me to do my PhD outside of the country. Now, before then, I'd always wanted to have at least one degree outside of Nigeria. So when he now began to, you know, encourage me that I should go outside. Now, by then, I was already thinking of applying to UI. Like, okay, since I've already done my master's here, let me just continue with my PhD. I did apply to UI, actually. I was admitted, but I think I left after 1 year. And I left because I got the admission to the DPS program at University of the Witwatersrand. So, you know, it was just, he was even the one who linked me up with the then head of department, who eventually became my supervisor. And that was how they began to guide me through to the process of applying, you know, for a PhD at WITS. And I think so that was basically it. So my decision to do a PhD had started a very long time ago before I actually, I think it had been a desire and a decision. And everything I was doing from 2008 was working towards that particular decision to do a PhD. So I think it started for me pretty early. And of course, you know, when you're in an academic career, I would encourage the fact that once you have decided you want to be in an academic career, try to do your PhD as soon as you can, as the earliest available opportunity. Because I can tell you for free that even in Nigeria today, there is a certain level you cannot rise beyond if you don't have a PhD. As of today that I know, except the rule is changed tomorrow. Initially, I was told that, you know, you can still make it to senior lecturer without having a PhD. But that, now that bar has been lowered. You can't make it beyond a lecturer one if you don't have a PhD in Nigeria. And I think for me, yes, you cannot make it. So until you have a PhD, you cannot move beyond the lecturer one. And another thing is, I think a PhD is something that you want to do and get out of the way as quickly as possible. Whether you're a man or a woman, you know, because of course we females also have our own peculiar challenges when it comes to career issues. But whether you're a man or a woman, I think when you do this, the earlier you do it and you get it out of the way, the better. Because for me, I would say having a PhD changes the trajectory of your career. It enhances it. It makes it faster. There's a lot more that is going to be committed. A lot more responsibility will be committed to you once you have a PhD, because people believe you are capable. Because a PhD is a sort of badge that the moment you say, I have a PhD, right? It's just like a sort of assurance. They feel like, oh, whatever I want to do is in safe hands. This person has a PhD. So when you do that, for me, number one, the first thing, even choosing to do it when I did it was like, let me get this thing out of the way. Right. I didn't want to, you know, because I have colleagues now who are much older than me age-wise, who are now trying to do the PhD. And it doesn't necessarily get easier the older you get.
Absolutely.
Because some people feel, oh, they want some life experience, they want some work experience before they start the PhD. I am so glad that I decided to do it when I did it, because now, you know, the more you rise in your career, the less free time you actually have to do certain things. And of course, you also have family commitments as a person, whether you're male or female, you have family commitments. So I know, I see, you know, I used to think, oh, it's harder for women, it's harder for women. But I see my male colleagues who are also on the PhD, who have young families, also struggle.
Absolutely. The family responsibility now these days, it's domestic chores have been it's no longer women's responsibility. Men
yeah,
also
even
contribute.
If it's not, even if it's not about the women's responsibility, because let's not kid ourselves, doing a PhD is expensive on many fronts.
Absolutely.
Financially expensive, it's time expensive, it's even mental health expensive. So you want to get that out of the way so that it's a PhD. I won't gloss it over and say PhD is a walk in the park.
This lecturer at the University of Ibadan, used to tell us we should try and get our PhD before we turn 30. If you remember.
I was 35 when I got mine. I was 35 when I got mine. But you understand, even I got mine at an age where I felt that I was behind. But even coming to compare myself with a lot, you understand, I realized that, yeah, I may have been behind on some fronts, but I've been able to, by the grace of God, catch up. Do you understand? But it's better, the younger you are, the more resilient you can be, the more, how do I put it now? The more resilient, the more you can easily accept the more you can easily accept disappointments and setbacks.
Absolutely. The more you even take correction, isn't it? Because kind of challenges is the more, the older you become.
I don't think it's about being about even the age as being able to take correction. Because I know people who are young who are as stubborn as, you know, at some point you just throw your hands up and like, you know what, I'm done with you. I can't do this anymore. But I think it's more about you're being younger. Yeah, more, because a PhD requires, I was still telling my mom and my sister yesterday, I said, you have to have a degree of stubbornness to do a PhD. And whether you call it stubbornness or you call it resilience, because resilience really is the refined point, the refined aspect of stubbornness.
Absolutely.
You have to be able to get knocked down several times, take negative criticism of all sorts and still get back.
Absolutely.
You need to be able to take the harshest of feedback and still be able to get back on your feet and say, you know what, I'm going to do this. You know, and I don't think you want to be doing all of that at an advanced age, so to speak. Because I do know we have people who get into the PhD, but I feel that, you know, because I have friends, you know, in their 50s and older who are doing PhDs. But what I'm trying to say is that, especially if you want to be an academic, you know, I've seen someone I had to ask, I said, you've accomplished so much on all fronts. You know, why exactly did you have to do this PhD? And he said, it's always been a dream of his. He does not, he may not want to use it, you know, for his career right now, but he feels that he's going to give him a sense of accomplishment. You know, that's fine. Some people even want to do a PhD because, you know, maybe political, whatever. They want to use it to advance their political career. They want to be, you know, acceptable as consultants. Some people who are maybe in the business world, for instance, want to do a PhD because they want to move to the consultancy space. You understand? Just like I said earlier, everybody assumes you are more skilled, you are more dependable when you have a PhD.
When you have a PhD. Now, speaking of your motivation, I was going to ask, who were your role models growing up? And another question I also want to add to that is, would you describe your family as an academic family? And would some of the motivation come from the kind of family you came from?
Okay. Let me see. Who were my role models? I didn't even know that role models were a thing probably until I was in my late teenage years. So, but I think I've always just been attracted to strong women. I've always just been attracted to career women. So in Nigeria, I would say that would be people like Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. There was this woman who was the director of the Securities and Exchange Commission then, Ndi Okereke Onyike. People like Ibukun Awosika. What's her name also? Dr. Obiezi Kwesili. You know, women like that. I think those were women. And that was why one of the people that got me interested in being an academic, like I said again, was a female lecturer in Ife, you know, Dr. Mrs. Obiya. I'm not even sure she knows me. I'm not sure she didn't remember me, but she probably never knew, because I think there was just something about her that I admired, let me use the word. And at that point, you know, some things are conscious and other things are subconscious. Maybe subconsciously I wanted to be like her. You know, because she was very, well, she was very beautiful and she was very articulate. And so I never got closer to her than probably a good morning. I never got closer to her. Ah, yes, then also in Ibadan, also in the UI, you had now Associate Professor Dr. Funke Fayo. I think looking at somebody who I felt was, you know, oh my God, she's so young and she's a doctor and she's already doing things. You know, so, yes, I think for me, women, when I say women who are achieving, I am very, you know, I'm very driven by them. I don't just want to be in the background of life. I think that's for me. So whenever I see women who are not just, who are achieving on them by themselves, women who have a voice. I think for me, that was one of the things that really drove me, really, really pushed me. So it wasn't just about, oh, I want to be like this person. It was the fact that I also wanted to be, you know, somebody who stood out. Whatever it is, I know that even if, had I even not chosen to go the route of, you know, being an academic, I would probably have been somewhere, maybe in finance or in the business world, with a voice of my own. You understand? So I've always been drawn to strong women. I've always been drawn to career women. So I think that for me was one of the things. Yes. Then am I from an academic family? No, not at all. Neither of my parents have a university degree. Yes, I grew up knowing I wanted to go to the university. I think that would be it. And that was encouraged, you know, right from a young age. My mom would always talk about, you know, you should grow up, you should go to the university, you should have a university degree. She wanted us to have at least a minimum of a master's. So I think that came from her. She wasn't necessarily an academic, but she recognized the value of education. And so I would not say I came from a necessarily academic family, so to speak. But I would say that growing up, my mother instilled the love of reading in us. We always read. We did a lot of reading. So maybe that was part of the preparation for the life I have now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So maybe she did not have a university degree, but she loved reading. She loved all about education. My mom even ran a school for children at a point. She ran a school for children at a point because she always just had an interest in education. So I think that was it. Basically, maybe that was the background that helped me that. While not, for instance, maybe I have one or two aunties who today one retired as a professor of hematology from the University of Lagos. She's my mother's cousin, but you know those senior cousins that they call themselves auntie and all that. So she retired as a professor of hematology from the University of Lagos. My mother has another cousin who is currently a professor of, I think, fine arts or something like that. I know she's a sculptor at the Tai Solari University of Education. So maybe from afar, those were the only two women I knew from my mother's side of the family who had an academic career. From my dad's side of the family, I'm the first female PhD holder.
Wow. It's incredible.
I have a cousin who got her PhD the year after I did mine. So, and I mentored her. She's my senior cousin too, but, you know, I did some mentoring. You know, there are times she'd reach out to me. She'd ask for, you know, assistance, helping her go through her research methodology, things like that. So, yes. So I would say I don't necessarily, I think, so in that case, I would say maybe I'm a first generation academic from both sides of my family.
Yeah. Now, so you've made a journey from University of Ibadan now to South Africa, University of this first time. I know you mentioned, you know, briefly how you established a connection with the University of WITS. But more importantly, I think, take us through a little bit more about the admission process itself, as well as funding the PhD.
Okay. So, like I said initially, I made first contact with my mentor then, Professor Uche Isiogo Abanihi, introduced me to the then head of department. Like I said, he became my supervisor. And, you know, he recommended me, you know, to him, said, okay, I've met this young lady. She wants a PhD. Actually, what happened was, and it's very funny, I knew I wanted to go to South Africa. I was initially supposed to go to the US, but I knew funds were not going to be very helpful in that direction. Like I said, at that point, I didn't have a lot of information about funding and scholarship opportunities like I do today. So I decided, okay, South Africa, it's closer, it will be cheaper, it's on the African continent, it's just 6 hours away from Lagos and all that. So I decided, okay, I would go to South Africa. So at that time, the University of Cape Town they had this, they called it, I think, the Hewlett something something Foundation Scholarship to study demography at the University of Cape Town. So I reached out to, I think, the university, the program administrator there, and I said, okay, I'll be interested in this. How do I go about applying? And I told her a bit about my background. I have, you know, my background is in social demography from the University of Ibadan. And so the person reached out to me. I can't remember whether it was a woman or a man. The person reached out to me and said, oh, you know, what we do here at UCT is more of mathematical demography. And for what you say you have, the person suggested, he or she suggested two departments I should. So the person suggested two universities, University of KwaZulu-Natal and University of Witwatersrand. For some reason, you know, I said, okay, let me check out these two places. For some reason, I don't know why, I cannot say why, I got on the website of the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And I looked at the website and I was like, what is this? And I logged out. Please, I hope they don't come from me from UKZN.
Hopefully, website is better now.
Hopefully it's better, but I don't know. I cannot tell you why. I really hope, you know, I don't know. So I just decided, okay, let me check out the other university I was told. And I checked it and I just looked. I said, this looks interesting. At that point, you know, my mentor was still telling me, he had even given me some contacts for the University of Pennsylvania in the US where he did his own PhD. So we had, you know, one of our pop-up meetings. We never planned these meetings. It was more like I just passed by his office and I saw he was in, and the door was always open and I was always welcome. So I walked in and I saw him, and, you know, I just told him, I saw this demography, you know, program in South Africa, University of, as I then, you know, me, I couldn't pronounce the South African W's. I just said, you know, I just saw this place, they call it WITS University. And I remember he just looked at me. He said, they call it WITS. I can't forget that. He just looked at me and said, they call it WITS. I said, oh, okay, WITS. So I saw this demographic program at WITS, and he said, oh, WITS is not a problem. The person who is there is a colleague, an acquaintance of mine. So that was how, you know, he introduced me to him. And my supervisor actually reached out to me. He even called me at a point when he came to Nigeria. And, you know, he guided me through the admissions process, you know. So that was how. So at that point, you know, it had its own issues because I had to do, I think, what they call SAQA in South Africa. Yeah. The South Africans, is their verification. You know about
qualification SAQA. Authority. Yeah.
Aha. So the South African Qualification Authority. So at that point, I think I was almost even losing the admission then because SAQA was not getting feedback from my university in Nigeria. So at the point, I had to go over and tell them, and yeah, we got the mail from SAQA, but you have to pay some. So I said, no, now.
This thing still keeps up right. Me up to today, you know?
I said, this my is wife, there right yeah. now. You should have at least reached out to me. I mean, all it would have taken is an SMS. You have my number on file, or you have my email address. All you need to do with that.
They can just respond to the email, right? Without even reaching out to you. They can just.
You're not even supposed to. I mean, it's a verification, for goodness sake. You aren't even supposed to even let me know, you know, that I was being verified, really. So long and short, so even I had even gotten a letter of rejection from the university that, you know, they hadn't gotten my full documentation and they were sorry, but they wished me all the best in life. And then I reached out to my supervisor and told him, your people are saying my admission is being denied. And he said, no, give me a few days and I'll, you know. And eventually, you know, I was given the admission and I resumed. I registered for the first time in February of 2015. So that was the process, actually. What helped also was I had a colleague whose brother was also a student at VETS at that time. So as at then, they required a lot of documentation, physical documentation. I know I spent quite a bit on courier fees, you know, having to send my documents to South Africa for verification, even him over there having to go back and forth between Johannesburg and Pretoria for, you know, verification. It was quite, I don't know whether the system has been changed, but I know SAQA then used to be the headache of many people. It wasn't an easy road then with SAQA. So after doing all that, like I said, I got my admission in February of 2015, and that was how the PhD journey officially started for me.
Great. So I know funding is usually another sort of challenge for many people that plan to pursue a PhD. So maybe you can speak about how you funded the PhD.
Okay. The first thing I will tell anybody out there listening, please don't make the mistake I made. Do not begin a PhD journey without having a confirmed source of funding. It's a mistake I made. It cost me a whole lot. Do not. And I say that to say this. A PhD is a journey that is already very rocky. And funding is one of the things that would make that journey very much smoother. Don't do it. You don't have a... In fact, I still had to tell a colleague of mine about 2 weeks ago. He got his PhD and admission, and I told him, I said, if you don't have funding for this, because it's outside of the country, I said, if you don't have funding for this, my guy, look for funding, especially if it's South Africa. Look for your funding, because nothing is guaranteed. South Africa, and I know they are trying to be, what's the word I can use? They give preference to their own citizens, which is a very good thing. So if you're a foreign student and you want to go to South Africa, it's advisable for you to have your own funding from outside of South Africa. That's the advice I would give, because it affected me a lot. There were times when I could not concentrate so much on my studies because I was trying to hustle some funds. I got into South Africa without the funding. The major funding I got for the first years of my PhD was the Postgraduate Merit Award, which the University of Witwatersrand generously gives to postgraduate students. So what happens with the PMA is that they pay your tuition, but you still have to pay international fees. And then they give you a quarterly stipend. I think they were given a stipend of about 2,500 rand every quarter when I was at WITS. They give the PMA, right, to most masters and also PhD students. So they pay your tuition, but you have to pay international fees. And then the stipend they give you, Now, it differs among different departments. I know friends who were in other departments who were receiving stipends from teaching assistantships from their departments. But in my department, it was not like that. Right. So it was a lot of hustling for me. A lot of my, should I say, I was not able to get funding from Nigeria because I started my PhD before I was confirmed. So I was unable to access the TET Fund scholarship, which is usually given to Nigerian scholars, academics to study outside of the country. So I was unable to access that. So I think basically it was my living costs were self-funded. Which, of course, you know what, foreign exchange. In fact, it was even better than now. But it was still a pretty sum. You know, every month you have to pay rent, you have to buy groceries. At least you eat. You've got to eat, you've got to take care of yourself. So the living costs were, you know, I was having to take care of that, which were quite expensive. And, you know, there are times where you need some extra cash. I would do, you know, certain jobs for people to try to get extra cash and all that, which don't forget the fact that all of this is taking out the time you should be spending doing your work. Now, I went over time with my PhD. Remember that I told you that I started my PhD in February of 2015. For the first 2 years, I was on a part-time basis. I was shuttling between Nigeria and South Africa. And eventually, I started my full-time in 2017. Full-time PhD in 2017, and I eventually finished. I submitted my thesis for, you know, my final thesis submission was in December of 2020, and then I got, you know, my my official letter of completion was in February of 2021. Then I graduated in July of 2021. So that journey could have been much shorter had I had a steady source of funding. You know, and it's because funding for me was a major source of stress in my PhD. I'm not going to cover that up. Funding was a major source of stress. And it doesn't matter, maybe except you come from a wealthy family who are ready to give you this opportunity. But if that's not the case, then you need to ensure that particular PhD offer comes with, you know, a monthly stipend, comes with some sort of scholarship covering your tuition, at least let it be that whatever funding you get is going to cover your tuition, whatever associated costs, and your living costs in the form of a monthly stipend. Because I assure you that when your finances are well taken care of, in fact, there are some times that mentally you're not going to be in the right place because you are having funding stresses. You understand me? You are going to struggle. You are trying to sit down and think properly. And at the same time, you are thinking, oh, hey, God, I have these bills. You understand? I have these bills that are looking in my face. So I would not advise anybody. I used to think, oh, maybe it's because I'm doing mine outside of the country. But I remember talking to a lady once who did hers in Nigeria. And she was telling me about the fact that she did her PhD at the University of Port Harcourt. And she was so broke that they were living in Port Harcourt at that point, but that because her house was far from the university, she had to move in with her elder brother who lived closer to the university. So her husband used to come and visit her in her brother's house. And they were living in her husband is based in Port Harcourt. She had to move into her brother's house. So you can imagine. So there was a day I was just commenting. I said, I can't, this PhD is just draining my finances. She said, it's like that for everybody. That is not, but today, of course, you know, that's all, you know, it's all in the past.
Now, how substantial is that front?
To be honest, that's a question I cannot answer because as of now, with the current exchange rates, the TET fund is probably not going to be very substantial. But as of when I should have applied for TET fund. I'm aware that TET fund as at then was paying in Naira. TET fund was paying anything from 9 million a year for 3 years, which should be about 27 million. It depends. People got different. I know some people got 15 million. I know some people who got, you know, more than that. Some got 12, some got 10. But if you think about the current exchange rates today, even a 27 million is basically about $27,000. And that's for 3 years. You and I know that, for instance, if you are going to the UK, and that $27,000 includes everything. I don't know, as of now, I cannot tell you whether it has been increased.
But at the time you got it, that's what I'm referring to. Well, did that contribute to easing your financial burden for the payroll?
I did not get TED fund.
Oh, sorry. I think I need to make that clarification because I thought you said you got
it. No. I said it was available, but I was not eligible for it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it was not available to me because I should have been at least confirmed before I started my PhD. I should have had my confirmation. I should have worked for the university for at least 3 years.
Okay.
Right. But I started my PhD. I think I started working with the university in December of 2013. And I applied for my PhD in February of 2015.
It's not up to 3 years.
So ideally, I should have waited till December of 2016 to even start at all. So because, you know, I couldn't wait for certain reasons, and I said, okay, fine, let we go chest time now.
Big mistake.
Let's see how the thing goes. Eventually, you know, somehow, you know, for contribution from my siblings, contribution from my mom, somehow we got there. I also had my mom's younger brother was also lovely, you know. Different times they would come up, you know, I needed some money to do something. They'd rally around, you know. They'd rally around and make it happen. You know, it was tough. And it shouldn't have been that tough had I had, you know, a steady source of funding. Like I say, a PhD already comes with its own stresses and challenges. So the advice is to make it, you know, reduce your stress on other levels. And also being unable to get funding. There were so many conferences that even local conferences in South Africa, for instance, where I did it about 3 times. I would submit a paper to a conference. The paper would be accepted, but I won't be able to attend the conference. Yeah, because there were no resources. I think the first conference I attended was my last year of my PhD, was the African Population Studies Conference. You know, the APC, African Population Conference, that was held in Entebbe, Uganda. So I just, and my PhDs, one of my PhD conditions was that I must present, you know, at an international conference. So before that, I'd presented at our own mini conference in our department in Johannesburg. You know, I think I'd done that before, but, you know, I just wanted at least one, you know, one international conference that was going to take me outside of South Africa. So when that particular conference rolled around, I submitted like 3 papers, they were all accepted, and the conference came funded, you know, not just fully funded in terms of hotel accommodation and flights and transport and what have you, but also they gave a stipend.
Wow.
So that was
good funding.
Oh, yeah, I tell you, it was very
good. So what funding was that? Was it the organizers that got the funding? Or?
No, this one was Bill and Melinda Gates. This was by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It was, I think, funding specifically for people who were doing their work in sexual and reproductive health.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so since my PhD thesis fell under that, I was able to apply. And it also had an age limit as at then. I think it was under 35, which I was at that time. So yeah, it was a sweet one for me.
There are always these opportunities to attend conferences as a PhD student. Especially if you're under 35, there are always scholarships that you can apply to. I myself enjoyed quite a few scholarships.
yeah.
During my PhD, when I was in my PhD, and even immediately after my PhD, I still managed to tap into some of these fundings, such as conferences. Now, so you are now into the program. There was funding challenges.
Uh-huh.
You spoke about your first 2 years being, you know, shortly part-time. Between being part-time. What does it really mean to be part-time? What does it mean by being part-time? What happened in those first 2 years?
The first 2 years, because like I said earlier, I wasn't a confirmed staff.
Mm.
So I was not given a study leave.
Okay.
So the first year. So the first time I went, I spent some weeks in Johannesburg, you know, taught base with my supervisor, and then I returned to Nigeria to resume my work duties at the university where I teach. The second year, I think I spent about 3 months in Johannesburg, you know, working on my PhD before I returned to Nigeria. So that was it for me. I would go to Johannesburg, spend some time, and then return to Nigeria. So it was until 2017 before I was finally granted a study leave. You know, so that for me was the first time I then moved over to Johannesburg, you know, full time. I started living and studying in Johannesburg. So before then, it was just I'd spend first time, spend a couple of weeks, second time, spend a couple of months. I'd go, I'd come back. But when I moved over to Johannesburg in 2017, I went there in, I think, February of 2017 or March. I can't remember quite well. I think February. I didn't return to Nigeria until September of 2018. And that was when I started collecting my primary data. I collected primary data in Nigeria. Then I returned to Johannesburg. I did my data analysis. I did my writing through all of 2019, some corrections 2020. Early 2020, I started preparing for my thesis examination, sent out my work for thesis examination July of 2020, received feedback in October, did my corrections, and I did the final submission in December of 2020. So I'll say the entire year 2020 was more preparing for exam, going out for exam, corrections, feedback, and then final submission.
Oh, okay. So take us through writing a thesis. What was your experience?
Writing a thesis was...
Was it so easy for you?
I think the initial stage was not easy.
Hmm.
The initial stage was not easy because I kept on making a lot of mistakes. I think that is where I would start from. I am somebody who I struggled with the initial part of the PhD because of my natural learning style. Now, I'm naturally somebody who has always relied on the teacher-driven model to learn. So, I see something, but somebody has to explain it to me. So transitioning from a teacher-driven model to a self-learning model was difficult for me. Because one thing about doing a PhD is that you are self-led. You move at your own pace. There's something my supervisor will say. The fact that two of you started PhD at the same time doesn't mean you're going to finish together.
Mm.
Doesn't mean you're going to keep pace. There are people who are going to start after you and finish before you. So it depends. And I think that's what I'll put out there for everyone that wants to do a PhD, that you must be self-led. And that is something I was not good with at the beginning and I struggled a lot. You must be able to learn things by yourself. A PhD is a training for independence. Because today now as a researcher, nobody's looking over your shoulder to say, do it like this. The assumption is that you know how to do it. So if you don't, and it's something I'm trying to inculcate in my students now, my students who I teach and mentor at the undergraduate level, that you have to be able to go out there and learn things by yourself. You don't, because if I knew that better, I wouldn't have struggled so much in the first few years of my PhD. You need to be able to go out there, find information for yourself, digest that information and make it make sense. But I had problems with that. So it took me into a lot of places I should not have gone. You get me? So I didn't know that it was so much of independence. I was always trying to lean on other people. Yes, in as much as, you know, it takes a village rather to raise a PhD. But nobody's going to put their work aside 100% to attend to yours for you or with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you have to learn how to get your own information, how to synthesize that information. For the longest time, my supervisor would say, this should not be in the statement of the problem. It's supposed to be in the background. I have no idea what he's saying. So it it was much later before I was able to understand that, oh, so this is what the statement of problem is supposed to be. And this is what I now began to understand. So not being coming from a system where I was used to somebody explaining everything to me, to the system where I had to figure things out on my own, to understand was what my first major challenge was. And that's why the first 3 years of my PhD was virtually like I didn't get anything done. In fact, I always say that my PhD really, I may have started administratively in 2015, February, but my PhD really did not start for me until about November 2017. Because it was like all the months and years before that point in time, I was doing a lot of going around in loops and circles. So I always say to myself that my PhD really started in November of 2017, because that was when I finally, you know, it's like a plane. It's like, you know, when you are in a plane and you are taxiing. So you push back from the gates and you are going from here to there. And it's almost like, where are we going?
I think in addition to that, also having a community is also important. I could imagine that the first year, first 2 years, you spent most of those 2 years back home. So you probably miss outside. Out on having a community. Someone who can actually have a chat, a quick chat with.
Absolutely. In fact, when I moved in, when I was right there, you know, we would have seminars. We would have, you know, there's somebody whose office you can just walk into. And we find out that most people don't find it easy to relate with somebody thousands of miles away via email. It's easier to do this thing face-to-face. In fact, sometimes in those face-to-face conversations is when one, you know, you are really seeing stuff. Oh, you see this book on their shelf. Oh, can I borrow this? I'll return it to you after a few days. You understand? But when you are away, it's more difficult to do all of that. In fact, the person whose book I borrowed, it was just somebody just said, can I borrow this book? And she said, she needs it also. I said, okay, let me just make a photocopy of this one chapter and I'll return it to you. You understand? And all of that is impossible. So by the time I got more established in my PhD, by the time the younger, you know, PhD students started coming in, I was even the one who used to tell them, I say, you can't stay away from the office, you know, for 5 days or 6 or 7 days a week. You're not talking to anybody and you're just working by yourself. You're going to struggle. And you don't have to do that. When some of us have been here before you and we can tell you, you can learn from our mistakes so you don't have to make them. You know, so that's what I told. And a lot of people who I you know, began to, I don't know whether to use the word mentor in my own way, you know, didn't have to go through the struggles that I did, because I was very open and honest. Look, guys, I've been here for longer than I should have been. And, you know, it was because this. So, you know, just open up. You have challenges. There's someone out around here who can solve those challenges for you. Oh, you are struggling with this particular issue. Oh, there's somebody who did it. You know, how about you talk to this other person? So I think trying to be on your own is not going to help you, except maybe on genius level, Shao.
I don't know. There's always one can learn. I mean, there's a lot, because you need to know how to analyze data, you know, to understand how to measure things. You need to learn how to write.
Even publication is a big issue. It's a big issue because somebody's going to come and, you know, when I got to Johannesburg, I found out that there were so many resources available. You could go to the library, they would have seminars. You could go to the other, because our department is, you know, sits in two schools. So we're both in the School of Social Sciences and the School of Public Health. So social sciences would have their workshops and training, what we would go. Public health would also have their own, we would go. So along the line, sitting through all of those workshops, learning things, in fact, we had so many resources available to us that do you understand, really helped me. You know, especially it was like, by the time I got there, in fact, the first 6 months, it was practically from one workshop to the other workshop to the other workshop, because it that was when I now realized that being in Nigeria and trying to get things done from Nigeria was not working at all. Added to the fact that, you know, I was more of a teacher-driven, do you understand? So by the time I now went through all of that, you know, teacher-driven, I was not able to sit down, begin to now transition from that person who was just a teacher-driven learner to somebody who could, you know, self-learn. So yeah, for me, so they say the PhD is not even so much about the thesis you write. It's about the person you, because I assure you that by the time you come to the end of a PhD, you're not going to be the same person you were when you started. You are even going to pick up, you know, it was recently I just realized I've picked up the skill of knowing how to figure things out now. And that was something I picked up during my PhD. Because before, I'll be waiting for somebody to come and explain it to me. But now I've got to the point where I just look at the thing. I look at it. Once I do a lot of, you know, tinkering around with it, I get it. So I think that for me, I think that is it. You need to be able to also be willing to unlearn and relearn. I think that was one of our icebreakers earlier. You need to be able to unlearn. You've known this, especially if you're moving to a very new environment. For instance, I moved all the way from Nigeria to another country. They already have their own system of education where I was. Do you understand? So I had to unlearn a lot of things that I had already known, you know, to be the case in Nigeria, and then learn what you have in this new, you know, this new community. So I think that going to a PhD with an open mind, but, you know, I tell people things like, and I'm so, so happy that you have this podcast, because there are a lot of people out there who want a PhD. You know, the idea of having a PhD is so romanticized. Oh my God, everybody's going to call me doctor. I know that. It's a long, tough, bloody road to get to this place. Do you understand? And maybe if some of us had been told some of the challenges that we would face, you know, when we got into the PhD, we would have been more prepared, you know?
Absolutely.
I was not prepared. I knew it would be tough, but I was not prepared. So at the first sign of challenges, I was already ready to, I was almost ready to hit it and run, like, oh, please, no. I can't do this. You know, I had people, and that's why I also talk about the village and the community. You know, I had this postdoc. He's now a professor at the University of Ibadan. University College Hospital Ibadan, you know, Professor Akinyemi. And he said to me, he said, Christiana, I told him, I said, you know what, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And he told me, he said, you are not going anywhere. You are going to finish it. You must finish it. Whatever it takes, you're going to give it. Whatever it takes, I know you can do it. Whatever it takes, you can do it. And, you know, having that kind of supportive community, you know, eventually finishing the degree and then sharing the news with these same people who were so excited and happy, I think it made it all worth the while.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, you've spoken about two main challenges.
Mm-hmm.
The first being the burden of funding, the financial burden and of funding in thesis and certain things you missed out. And then you also spoke about, if I'm not mistaken, you spoke about the lack of community in the first 2 years.
Yes.
Now, are there other challenges?
For me, I think those are the two major ones.
Two major ones, the two substantial ones.
Everything else is going to differ based on your person and personality. What could have been a challenge for me? You know, other things I would look at and say, oh, these were challenges for me, may not necessarily be the same for others. So before I scare anybody of being a PhD, I just want to say that, you know, for me, you know, not having the community and finances are the two major things I'll talk about. All other things could have been due to maybe my own immaturity. Or my own, you know, not being able to adapt to certain situations as I should have. Do you understand? But I think these two major ones are the ones that I would point out and say, you know what, you know, these are things that I I found to be challenges. For others, if you get a good funding, I mean, the finances is no longer a problem.
Now, I think there's also one issue that I think is also important. I know a lot of the success of PhD rests to some extent with our ability to manage relationship between you as a student and your supervisor.
Oh, yes.
At least to some extent. I've actually seen people even quit the program because they just couldn't figure out how to manage that relationship. But what do you have to say, you know, in terms of managing this relationship? What sort of advice do you have for students? Yeah.
I say something. No matter the kind of supervisor you have, always remember that that is a relationship with a timeline. And I told somebody something once. I said, look, if you are at loggerheads with your supervisor for any reason, now, this may not sound, you know, woke, but if you're at loggerheads with your supervisor for any reason, just bend and do what your supervisor wants. This is why I said this. I told them, one thing I had made up my mind is, you can do certain things. You can make certain concessions. But remember that as soon as you're done with the PhD, you're done with your supervisor. And after the PhD, you can do whatever it is you want to do. You just want the degree, don't you? So that is trying to prove, trying to go head-to-head with your supervisor. Except in cases where there are clear violation of boundaries, such as in the case of sexual misconduct, because I've heard quite a few stories, especially between, you know, maybe male supervisor, female students, female supervisor, male students. Except there is a case of this person wants to take sexual advantage of you, or otherwise. I was telling somebody who was detailing his experiences with his supervisor, and today it's all, he's gotten his PhD. And it's all, do you understand, in the past. It's not a marriage. That's what I used to tell myself. It's not a marriage, for goodness sake, except you choose to marry your supervisor, and that's on you. It's not a marriage. It's a relationship that has a timeline. Sometimes you have some frustrations. The same supervisor you may have issues with may be another person's best friend.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So the question is now, is it you or is it the supervisor? In as much as I'm not saying they are not supervisors who are absolutely and totally irrational. But sometimes you come to realize, as you may think at the point you are doing your PhD, your supervisor is the worst person in the whole world. But I promise you, you will still leave that PhD and meet other people who are more toxic than that supervisor you think is a bad person. Or for whatever reason you're having, what should I call it? Whatever reason you're having issues. So at the end of the day, you come to realize that even your managing your supervisor relationship is part of what you learn in the PhD. In as much as I'm not giving license for supervisors to be toxic. Neither am I don't think that the supervisor-student relationship should be a toxic one, because it really makes the work easier when both of them are getting along fine. Do you understand? But I would say that it's part of the relationship you learn to manage. Okay, what happens when your supervisor is not the problem and it's even your cohort mates that are deliberately sabotaging your efforts? Are you going to run away? Are you going to run away from them too? What do? You manage. You manage the relationship. Because no matter what it is you go through, there will always be people out there who are ready to even do worse. I remember even before I even got into the academic, my academic job at all, I had a manager at work who was, I don't know, there's no other word to it. She was just toxic. She just wanted to, you understand. And I remember when I even said I was resigning, I could see that she was not happy about the fact that
she was unhappy.
She was not happy about the fact that I had escaped her. You understand? So there's people everywhere, you know. Managing supervisor relationship is very important, because look, your supervisor can be your best ally if you know how to, you know, manage that relationship properly. So just do that thing. Your relationship, whatever it is you are doing with them, is time bound, for goodness sake. If you do your work properly, 3-4 years you're out of there, except maybe in the US where it's 5 years.
But also with a master's degree.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, the traditional PhD should be anything between 2 and 4 years. So if you do it well, you know, you do your stuff, you manage that relationship quite well. You do your stuff for 3 years. That whatever it is that is between the both of you is over. And you're on your merry way. So, like I told the person, I said, look, your supervisor is saying you must do this. I said, look, my sister, what you need is a PhD. That's just the truth. What you need is a PhD. And at the end of the day, just do it and get out of there. So there's no point in, except, like I said, except in cases where there's clear violations of boundaries and respect and, you know, and sexual, like I said, I've heard. In fact, I know somebody who had to abandon her PhD because, you know, her supervisor was being funny.
Yeah.
And I know it's not an isolated story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cases. And if you do have those situations, then I think universities make, at least I know in South Africa, then you can request to change your supervisor. You know, if that is a situation where you feel you absolutely can no longer work with this person, you have an option. You can still, if I know, I want to change my supervisor. So I think these are some of the things that the supervisor relationship is very important, because, I mean, most of the time, your supervisor serves as a gatekeeper. Do you understand? So just do what you need to do. Finish with the degree. You get that PhD. You get the skills you need. And another thing I've learned is, whatever it is I go through, it's a learning opportunity also for me. If you say your parents were toxic, when you have your own children, don't be toxic.
Happy? Absolutely.
Parents were bad. Your parents did this. Your parents were abusive. When you have your own children, do differently. If truly you are dealing with a toxic supervisor, when someday you also become a supervisor, always remember to be kind. Always remember to lead with kindness and with gentleness. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting just sort of listening to your experience.
A pleasure.
Let me ask one general question. And this sort of deals with publishing, because I know it's also an important issue for many PhD students. I'm talking about the ones already in the program. In fact, some program will not even allow you to graduate if you do not publish.
Yes.
Papers. Yeah. So, what were some of the key lessons that you think? Yeah, in publishing, that you think PhD students need to quickly pay attention to, so that they also do not, just exert unnecessary pressure on themselves, or, you know, face that huge challenge of not being able to graduate because they have not published.
Okay. I think I would say this, that nowadays there's an option that even makes publishing easier. This thing of PhD by publication. Some universities, some departments offer that. I know at VETS there's an offer of that. In my own department, it was both PhD by thesis and publication. That's the way I describe it, because you have to produce a thesis, but you also have to publish, you know, before you graduate. Now, the school's regulation was at least one. The school's regulation was at least one. My department was at least three.
Wow, okay.
I had two papers published before I graduated, and then one paper was in between submission and rejection and eventual submission. And, you know, I think I must have bounced that paper around 3 or 4 journals before it was accepted. So what I'm trying to say is that the earlier you begin to publish, the better for you. Because if you are going to remain in academia, publication is something you cannot avoid. Writing and publication, as long as you choose to remain in academia, not just in academia, even if you choose to move to the NGO space, writing is still something you're not going to leave behind, except you decide you are not going to make use of the research component of your PhD at all. So the earlier you begin to publish, the better for you. Number one, it gets your name out there. Number two, it gives you practice. You only learn to write by writing. And the more you write, the better. I look at papers I wrote about 5 years ago compared to what I do now, and I can see the clear difference. So the more you write, the better, the more you polish, the more polished you become. The more you write, the easier it becomes. The more you write, the more experience you have, the more you can, you know, easily get things together. It becomes part of you. Now, another thing I'll say is avoid predatory journals. Avoid those journals that promise you, give us your paper today and we'll publish it in 2 weeks. Avoid them. Why? Because they are going to make a mess of your career for you. Why? Because predatory journals don't have the rigorous peer review required to make good writers. They get your journal article from you today. In 2 weeks, it's already published. They publish it as is. You go online, you see some journal articles full of grammatical errors, full of every kind of error you can imagine. Do you understand? It doesn't make you... See, there was one particular paper. The one I said was rejected. It was rejected from about 2 journals. In fact, I was already getting discouraged until I heard that there was a special issue and all of that. And I just said, let me just try this paper. When I put it in, that was my first ever qualitative paper. The kind of peer review I went through, in fact, I was just like, God, thank you that they didn't reject this thing, because the kind of rigorous peer review it went through. But by the time I was done polishing that paper, even from that process, I learned so much. Initially, it was like, oh my God, they've come with another round of comments. But it taught me that the next time I want to write a qualitative paper, this is how I do. Now, I have learned from that process, because before that point, I had written more of all of my papers before then had been quantitative, you know, data analysis and reporting and all that. So this was my first time writing a qualitative paper. Now, I went through all of that. I can assure you that some of the things that they told me then have been beaten into my head. I can't forget them again. Do you understand? So you have to, the more you write, and it helps you, because I met people who, even as a PhD students, already had papers in double digits. There was a particular lady then that we were doing a PhD then. She had like about 22 publications or so. And I know before she finished her PhD, she must have leveled up to maybe 30 or even more.
Writing, that's a prolific person.
So writing helps you to... And again, when you first start out, you may not choose to be the first author. You may choose to collaborate with a senior colleague who has already written before. Maybe you just come in as a backup. Do you understand? I remember when I wanted to do my first auto publication, I just had this date and I just said, let me see what's going to happen. And I wrote the draft of the manuscript and I sent it to one of my senior colleagues. And she made her comments and everything. And, you know, I made her the second author. And, you know, and I wrote that. And it was accepted. Do you understand? It was accepted. And from that point, I gained confidence after that to begin to write and write more. So you're not going to, you don't wish yourself into having many publications. You have to do the work.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You have to do the work. And the way you do the work is to write. You may have, you know, just sometimes jot down random ideas, you know, in your head. Like, okay, what would sometimes even just have those ideas ready so that maybe you get an opportunity that is calling for a grant or is calling for a proposal for either a fellowship or a grant. You already have something that is in your mind. You quick do your literature review. You write something. You put something together. You write. Sometimes it's a conference. You write an abstract. You send. You get that opportunity. The more you write, the better at it you get. And the more confident, again, you also get.
Yeah. If I'm to recap, so you said quite a lot of things. One, start early. It's important to start publishing as early as possible. You've also said that it's important to... you know, collaborate with senior people that have actually written before. It's really important. You said the only way to learn how to write is also to write. You learn by writing. And then you said avoid predatory journals. Stay far away from them because they will mess it up. That's how you said it. So I think these are important tips. I just thought I need to recap that for our listeners. Now, speaking of your post-PhD experience, how has it been? Would you say given all the sacrifice, would you say it's been worth it getting a PhD?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I have no regrets. I have zero. In fact, if I can say I have negative, I have negative regrets. I don't have any regrets whatsoever, because I can tell you that after that, it has been very, very, very good. Now, different people choose different options, you know, post-PhD. Some choose to maybe go into industry, some choose to go into academia. No matter where you go with a PhD, I tell you, PhD, by the grace of God, opens doors. In fact, there are some people I'm talking to on the phone. The moment I say, oh, yeah, I'm Dr. So-and-so, they're already at a lab. They want to hear. They feel I have something important to say. The moment you go somewhere and they introduce you and say, oh, this is Dr. So-and-so, everybody's like, oh, wow. Do you understand? So, yeah, that's the cosmetic aspect of it. But I must say that, you know, people have confidence. There are some opportunities that, you know, you're more likely to get if you have a PhD. You're more likely to get those opportunities if you have a PhD, because people assume that you have the expertise. Well, that should be true. You should have the expertise, really. It's also something that you do as it's a sort of certification that you are able to do independent research. So there is the belief that, oh, once you have a PhD, even if you are going to be working on a research project, we can give you a more senior role. You know, because, I mean, if you've been able to coordinate an entire PhD, you know, research and thesis, then you should be able to handle this. You understand? It also gives you that confidence. Like, one of the things I told myself was, did I want to go back for a postdoc, or I just wanted to do fellowships? Do you understand? Because with doing fellowship, I feel like I'm learning more as an independent researcher. I'm having to, you understand what I mean? I'm having to figure out things, whereas if I had a PhD supervisor, a postdoc, a mentor, I'd be leaning more on the expertise of my mentor. But choosing to do more of independent research post-PhD has made me have to lean on myself and then bring out, you understand, certain skills, organizational skills, and what have you. So I think that post-PhD has been quite interesting for me, because it's like in the past, I finished, let's say this is my second going third year post-PhD, and the kind of opportunities I've been able to get were far more than what I had before I got the PhD. So yeah, for anybody out there who is choosing to do a PhD, I'll say go for it, but also have all of these things in, you know, in view before before you get into it, that a PhD, I know, and I must tell you, I used to think, well, maybe it's because I'm in Africa that the PhD is so difficult. And I remember meeting up with some other PhD students from, you know, I've met up with PhD students from all over the world, and everybody has similar stories to tell. So don't think that, oh, maybe it's because I did mine in South Africa. Maybe if you run to Europe or America, you have it easier. I have friends who did their PhDs in America also. And if you sit down and discuss, you know, because really the funny thing is I had a lot of friends around me who either have done or are doing PhDs. And, you know, when we meet and we are comparing notes, you find out that the stories are similar.
Absolutely. One final question from me would be, I know that the journey post-PhD is not always, and that's the reason why I ask the question whether it's really mean what it's not always the same for everyone. So, and that's what, you know, leads me to this question. What makes a successful PhD?
What makes a successful PhD?
A PhD question, isn't it?
It's not an abstract question. It's a very logical question. But I'll say for me, because I'm a Christian and I know that nothing I do without the grace of God, I will talk first for me. It was by the grace of God. And then I won't just be abstract, because a lot of people will say, it's the grace of God. No, I'm going to be very practical. Because it takes, number one, it takes, like I said, it takes the grace of God. Because I mean, it's God that gave me life. You know, if He didn't give me life or mental health, you understand? I don't know how I could have finished. In fact, I would say I became much more prayerful and spiritual during my PhD. Yes, that I would say. The second one, I think it would be about resilience. There is a saying that can sound very cliche until you are going through it. It's when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And I experienced that very much in the PhD. There were many goings that became tough. But also remember another saying, which may also sound like cliche. It says, tough times never last, but tough people do. That I had to learn that no matter what it was I was going through in my PhD, it had a time limit. So I learned to say something, I said, this too shall pass. Like, no matter what it is I'm going through, there's a time limit to everything that I'm going through. One day, I would end up, you know, finishing this PhD. So I think it's that resilience of, this PhD is not going to see the end of me. I'm going to see the end of this PhD. And I'm not quitting. Because the moment, I learned something in my PhD, that the moment you take your stand and say, I am going to figure out how to get through this, I am not giving up. And that, for me, is the best attitude you can have. Because if you are somebody who ups and runs at the first sign of a crisis, you're not going to be able to do a PhD. And I'm not saying that with any form of ego or pride or disrespect either. Because there are different people. There are people I know who had to quit for health reasons. There are people I know who had to quit because they had marital challenges. Okay, so sometimes people do quit PhDs for reasons that are bigger than them. I know someone who said, I have to choose right now between my PhD and my life, and right now I choose my life. So I'm not gonna belittle that and say, oh, maybe it's because they weren't strong enough. No! Because I know it takes a whole lot of spiritual, mental, physical strength to complete a PhD. But I say that again to say this, that you have to be the kind of person who looks things in the face and says, look, you know what? I'm going to finish this. There was something in my PhD, there was a mantra I used to say. I say, when I can't fly, I'm going to run. When I can't run, I'm going to walk. When I can't run, I'm going to crawl. But by all means, I'm going to keep moving. There are days when I would wake up and I'm like, I can't handle heavy work today. So let me just do the lighter parts. But the most important thing is at the end of the day, I've done something. So maybe today I'm not in the mood to handle this data analysis. I'm not in the mental space to do it. Okay, let me just do some. I'm supposed to add some literature here and there. So let me just do that one. I mean, maybe that's what I'm in the mental mood for. Oh, maybe, okay, today I'm not in the mood to do this thing, but I have to work on some other section. So most importantly, at the end of the day, I've gotten something now. Do you get me? So I think for me, that was the major thing. Keep moving. Even if you are not moving very fast, just do something.
Absolutely.
So at the end of the week, you'll be able to say, I did this.
And remember, PhD is not written in a day or in a week.
Oh.
It's a sum of all the little things you do on a daily basis over the 4 years.
telling you.
That sums up to get your PhD. Yeah.
I'm telling you.
There's this question. It's just about your sort of gender. I don't know whether it's a gender peculiarity to getting a PhD, but from a female perspective, I don't know what the data seem like, but it's just seemed to me like more men are doing PhD than women. I don't know. I don't have any data to back that up. And I think one of the reasons for that is women sometimes always feel like they need to make themselves small.
Yeah.
It's the masculine ego. Any advice on this particular topic for maybe young ladies listening to the podcast?
Okay. Now, if you're a young lady listening now, I can assure you that when you say you want to do a PhD, most likely you're going to be advised not to. Most likely. Even me, when I wanted to do mine, there were people who came up and said, no, don't do it now. Wait until you get married. Yada, yada, yada. There are always going to be people that would advise you not to do it. But I told myself, I said, if I don't get this PhD, I'm going to regret it for the rest of my life. If I didn't take the opportunity to get the PhD, if I didn't take the opportunity to get that PhD when I did, when the opportunity came to go to the VITS to do that PhD, had I missed that opportunity. I can't promise you I would have a PhD, or I'll be even working on a PhD anywhere today. That's the truth. As a lady, most likely, and that's how you should be, mindful of the kind of community you have. There are people who feel that having a PhD is too much of an achievement for a woman. But the question I would ask is, who's writing the story of your life? Are you going to let naysayers write the story of your life? I've met several women now today who decided to wait until they got married and finish raising their children before having a PhD. And it's not necessarily easier for them. In fact, the dropout rate for them is often high. So if you're a young lady out there and you want to do a PhD, go for it. People are going to tell you no. If you know you are convinced you want to do that, you don't just want to do it for the, should I say the glamour now? Though I don't know. People assume PhD has glamour, but well, I don't know. It depends on
a lot of work, there. Isn't it?
It's a lot of work, really. It's a lot of, you know, behind the smiles and those academic gowns, trust me, there have been. I say that a PhD is blood, sweat, and tears. Because I don't know about you, but there were many days where I would just break down and cry. Ah, God, what is happening here? You know, but what I'm trying to say is, as a female, except you come from maybe a very academic, cerebral family, most likely you're going to be discouraged. People will say, no, it's too much. It's too much. Just, you know, some even ordinary ones with a master's, some would still even discourage you. But that is why you know your tribe. Stick with your tribe. And if you are convinced you want to do it, go ahead. Me, I believe in big dreams. I believe in taking giant leaps of faith. Don't let what anybody tells you, you know, stop you from achieving your dreams. Because I can tell you that no matter what happens to you, the regret of having a dream you could not achieve is not something that is easy to live with. Me, I know that for sure. That's why I told you. I said, I have no regrets. Did I have people who discouraged me? Even colleagues at work discouraged me when I wanted to get a PhD. You can imagine.
The educated ones.
I'm telling you, the supposedly educated ones discouraged me when I said I wanted to go for a PhD, especially when I even said I wanted to go for it outside Nigeria. Ah, what are you looking for up and down? This one, that one, wants. Everybody's going to talk to you from the lens of their own opinion. But the question is, you, what do you want? Are you going to let your entire life be dictated by what other people want for you? Come on now. This is the 21st century, for goodness sake. I don't think being a female, you should be. I mean, look at women like Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. What do you call it? Dr. Obi Ezekwesili. Are these women, do you feel these women are in any way incapacitated today because they have a PhD? When they talk, people listen.
Absolutely.
Look at the late Dora Akinyele, Professor Dora Akinyele before she died. Come on now. These are women. Yeah. These are women. And yes, I know there's always the issue of, you know, family life, the family thing. Okay, that's why you should marry a man that has sense. That's the best capsule I can put in it. You already have a partner who is saying he doesn't want you to have a master's and you are comfortable with that. So what's going to happen? World War 3, 4, and 5 are going to break out if you say you want a PhD. So I think that's what I have to say about that, really. Being a female should not stop you from achieving your dreams. It shouldn't. Absolutely. I had, for instance, there was one of my colleagues who had a baby. I still remember the day she wanted to submit her PhD proposal. I was the one who carried her daughter up the stairs. You know, because she was struggling to carry her last. And I said, bring your daughter, let me carry her for you. And that was her second child. And I believe she had the two children while on the PhD program. So what are we saying? It's doable. Very absolutely doable.
So it's on this note that we will wrap up the conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your journey on my PhD experience podcast. You see, I've listened a lot. I've also learned just by listening to your story. And and I think it's important that we not only listen to this podcast, we also share. We comment, like, and share and spread the message to as many students or aspiring students that these podcasts can help. So thank you, Christina. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was an absolute pleasure.